sure or safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Allison Keyes. We're learning more now about the man who killed 18 people in a mass shooting in Maine this week. Police found him dead last night and are releasing new information about Robert Card. Maine's Public Safety Commissioner Michael Soschuk says a note was found.
It's a note to a loved one and is saying that this is the passcode for my phone. This is the bank account numbers. And I wouldn't describe it as a explicit suicide note, but the tone and tenor was that the individual was not going to be around and wanted to make sure that this loved one had access to his phone and whatever was in his phone.
The head of the United Nations is criticizing Israel's bombing of Gaza, demanding an immediate ceasefire as Israel ramps up its air and ground attacks. Hamas attacked Israel October 7th. CBS's Remy Innocencio with the latest.
Israel is starting its payback, said an advisor to the prime minister, for the October 7th massacre by Hamas. More than 200 hostages taken that day are still being held, many believed to have been spirited underground. Amir Ulo is an Israel Defense Force reserve colonel.
I'm not telling you that it's going to be easy. And I'm not telling you that we are not going to face losses. We will. But when it's time to war, we know how to fight. And we will do it and we will prevail.
President Biden has more competition for the Democratic 2024 nomination. CBS's Robert Costa.
Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips is off to the races and hitting the campaign trail, officially launching his long shot bid for the White House in New Hampshire ahead of the state's primary. The congressman has a daunting path ahead as he tries to ramp up a campaign, establish a national profile, all while confronting the skepticism of many veteran Democrats.
Some in the nation are watching the skies today. Kelly Cass is at the Weather Channel.
The heavy rain in the south, this is where we could see additional flash flood warnings, especially in the Dallas area where we've already seen anywhere from 6 to 9 inches of rain, another 2 to 3 inches on the way.
World Series Game 1 was crazy, with the Arizona Diamondbacks losing their lead and then the game to the Texas Rangers. Corey Seager hit the tying two-run homer in the ninth inning in an exciting series opener. Rangers manager Bruce Bochy.
That was a great game. Entertaining game. Great ball game. We had some chances out there. Couldn't quite get that big hit, but late we did.
The Rangers won 6-5 in 11 innings, and Game 2 is tonight in Texas. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Family farm advocates in rural western Wisconsin are pushing back on concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, as the livestock industry becomes more concentrated. But local officials are also digging in. Here's Mark Moran.
Hundreds of residents of Pierce County, nestled along the Wisconsin-Minnesota border, are concerned about a proposed expansion of CAFOs in the county. Danny Akinson, with a group called Grassroots Organizing Western Wisconsin, or GROW, asked county officials to put a moratorium on CAFO expansion.
That moratorium did not pass. In its place, the county decided to create a groundwater advisory committee, which will be studying the effects that CAFOs can have on our groundwater.
Similar efforts at halting CAFO expansion have failed in other Midwest and Plains states, where advisory groups have also been formed, and where CAFOs have the potential to pollute groundwater. Large corporate-owned farms say their operations are more efficient than small family farms and are simply meeting a growing demand. Akinson says advocates are trying to work with local officials to at least slow CAFO expansion. Known for dairy farms and cheese curds, residents of Pierce County towns such as River Falls, Spring Valley, and Ellsworth want to preserve the rural, pristine way of life the area is known for.
A lot of people come here looking for that rural way of life that you would not get in a place like the Twin Cities, for example.
CAFOs have been cited for a host of environmental problems as they expand across the country. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Mark Moran. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Cripescast. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. I'm your host, Charlie Behrens, and here is today's episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Cripescast. I am joined by Colleen Maraca, the EP of the Cripescast here in the Cripescast studio.
Hello.
Today on the Cripescast, my guests are Alex Beld and Francisco Seyu. Alex is the communications director for Renew Wisconsin, and Francisco is the emerging technology director. And Renew Wisconsin, it's a nonprofit org, very cool organization dedicated to building a stronger, healthier, and more vibrant Wisconsin through the advancement of renewable energy. Mm-hmm. We are talking about everything from solar panels to buses, bioenergy, geothermal, hydropower, wind energy. It's just kind of a cool way to sort of see what Wisconsin is doing to, you know, push as much bipartisan legislation. And I think the thing with renewables, it is very bipartisan. There's a lot of money in renewables. It's a good thing to do for the environment. It's kind of a win-win for everyone, but it's just sort of figuring out what are the best ways to do it and what are the most effective ways. And that's kind of where this conversation is going. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin is also kind of like a microcosm, you know, for the rest of the nation. So if you're not from Wisconsin, you know, this conversation will still show you what is possible here, what could be more possible in your state. Maybe you're in a state that has more sun, you know, maybe you're in a state that does not have sun. Some of these things will apply, some of them won't, but it gives you sort of like a structure to say, how is my state doing what Wisconsin is currently trying to do?
Right. And specifically like Midwest states too, they talk about how like other states bordering us are already doing. The main thing they came to talk about is like a electric school bus and like how states, I think it's Michigan and Iowa, are already doing that. So it's mm-hmm. like if you're in the Midwest, it'll hit home for you. If not, like Charlie said, there's some things that will, some things that won't.
Yeah. So, yeah. We'll get to that conversation in a second. Before we do, Colleen, what do we have cooking here in Cripes Inc.? We got anything going on?
We do. We are announcing more and more tour dates, which is exciting. So we are coming up in December. We got your New York City show December 10th. So go check out Charlie and the Big Apple. And then we also just announced some shows in January in North Dakota. He's doing Fargo, Grand Forks, and Bismarck.
Miles is coming to the Fargo one, by the
way. Oh, nice. Is he going to do some time?
He'll probably get up on stage, you know. He'll probably say something, rally the crowd, that, and the other thing.
I love that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, and there's tons more. We just announced Madison date. There's a lot coming up in the spring. So if you haven't seen Charlie yet this year, don't worry. Go to cripescast.com/tour and you'll be able to see where you can see Charlie live. And then also too, it's your last week. This is your final reminder for October. So if you get a purchase of $100 or more of Midwest merch at ManitowocMinute.com and you add the orange oat beanie to your cart and use code OCTOBER at checkout, you get that orange beanie free.
Heck yeah.
So
shall we get to it?
Yeah.
My conversation with Renew Wisconsin. Here it is, ladies and gents. Thank you guys for coming on. Are you both in Madison?
Yeah, we are.
Nice, nice. So why don't we just start, you know, with the straight up elevator pitch, you know? Let's just get it out there for folks who don't know anything about renewable energy. They don't know anything about transportation or, energy systems. What's wrong with the system and what do you guys propose?
We are here representing Renew Wisconsin. And Renew Wisconsin is a nonprofit organization that has been around since 1991 supporting the clean energy transition in the state of Wisconsin. And by clean energy, we mean we live in a system that uses energy to run everything, right? It takes energy to run life. You need energy to power your house. You need energy to power things at work. You need energy to move you around from place to place. A lot of the work Renew has done over the years in the state has focused on the transition to clean electricity, supporting people's access to solar energy, for example. You know, we live in a world where we like to support local initiatives, and it is no different in the energy sector, where if you generate your energy locally, you're not sending money out of your house or out of the state or out of the country. And that's part of the reason we're doing this, right? We want to support initiatives and programs and laws that will allow us to create as much of our electricity, as much of our energy here in the state, so we don't have to send money out of the state. So just to put some numbers around that, I have a background in engineering, so I think in numbers. So the state of Wisconsin does not produce any petroleum products. So every time we burn a gallon of gasoline or diesel fuel or jet fuel, we're sending money out of the state to purchase that fuel somewhere else. That number in Wisconsin right now is somewhere around $12 to $14 billion every year that we send out of the state economy to purchase those fossil fuels. Our goal is to support programs and to support initiatives that would allow us to power our economy with fuel that we can generate here in the state to keep those dollars in the state to support jobs and to support the economic well-being of the state.
Yeah, so, I mean, that makes a lot of sense right there. Why, send money out of the state for a product that we all use? I mean, it's Wisconsin, though, has a history of that, a very recent history. I mean, they're sending people to Illinois for weed, Michigan for weed. You know, every state that touches Wisconsin has some weed. But Wisconsin's like, no, we don't want that money, man. We don't want that tax revenue. It's against, I don't know why we don't do it, but we have a pattern of that a little bit. So yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's great. I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, this is the way we have done things here, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we always done things this way. And there is value for wanting to do things the way you know and wanting to stay close to the things that you understand. But the world doesn't work like that all the time, and we need to evolve. And in the energy space, we have the technology that has evolved, and we need to catch up with it. So we need to create a framework here in the state. We need to create laws. We need to create programs that will allow citizens in the state to take advantage of technology that has matured enough to provide savings and to improve the quality of life of people here in the state. So we're here to talk about electric school buses. That's a perfect example of a technology that has matured enough that will allow us to fulfill the mission of that thing, which is taking kids to school safely, reliably. We can do that, and we can do that in a vehicle that doesn't poison the kids and that doesn't doesn't send our money out of the state. Well, we can power that bus with energy that's generated here.
Okay. So we can power that bus with, but what about the, I was just listening to something about the batteries, how big those batteries are on buses. Is it, with mining those, with getting the lithium to mine those and everything like that, is that that's, one of the problematic areas in the, in not just the from an environmental standpoint with strip mining and everything. Now, let me also say, before I start talking more about this for those listeners out there who may be skeptical of electric vehicles, drilling for oil is also very damaging to the environment. So any way we get any resources, it's damaging. So it's not like, oh, you're mining for lithium, that means electric vehicles are bad. I think overall, it's certainly a huge step in the right direction. But with that, I think, We just want to sort of at least address that. We do have to bring those in from out of state, right? We're not mining lithium or anything in the state of Wisconsin. Is that correct to say?
That is correct. And Alex, go ahead.
Yeah. So, like you said, Charlie, most of the resources that we collect for energy production are to fuel vehicles, mining's involved or drilling's involved. Same with coal. You know, there's mountaintop coal mining, which you just literally blow up the top of a mountain to extract that coal. Mining for lithium and other metals like zinc and things like that, it's not always great for the environment. But unlike coal, there is the possibility of recycling those batteries. So as that technology gets better, we have a pathway out of doing as much mining. Mm-hmm. But I did want to go back to one of the points of something we generally advocate for, which ties in well with electric buses, is part of the reason why we advocate so heavily for renewables is just generally improving the quality of life from a health standpoint, right? Yeah. There's just going to be less smog in the air, less fumes in the air, things like that. So that's a very large part of what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely seems like a step in the right direction. And also, Francisco, I apologize. I think I cut you off there when you were talking about how it is sort of in Wisconsin. So like the battery aside, you know, which we don't produce here, but we're trying to produce more of that in the United States as opposed to sending those, getting those resources from China, for instance. So how is it a closed gap system? How do we have that energy? How are we getting that electric energy in Wisconsin? I think that's where you were going next with that.
Yeah, but I do appreciate your concern for the sustainability aspect of the transition. I think that it's something that we don't want to overlook, the fact that there are some concerns with our supply chain and there are some concerns with batteries. Now, I love the fact that you brought the other side into focus too. It's not like, you know, oil extraction is not a benign process. And we've seen a lot of environmental issues from that. So it's like we're dealing with a situation that we're dealing with an imperfect system. And the thing that I like about the transition, the clean energy transition, is the fact that we're still doing a lot of the research, we're still learning a lot, and we're committed to doing things the right way. That doesn't mean that we're doing everything perfect today, but we definitely want to do things better. So in terms of, you know, battery chemistry, you know, batteries are a relatively nascent market because they haven't been a huge, huge demand for the kind of batteries that we need today. And I can almost guarantee you that 10 years from now, the battery supply is going to be much, much better than it is today, because that market is evolving in that way, and we're being mindful of doing things in a way that is responsible. So I don't want us to get too caught up on the, what's going on with batteries today, because, you know, we're going to see things like battery recycling, which is a business that's going to boom because there is a huge economic opportunity there, and businesses are going to take advantage of that opportunity. Nobody's going to throw those raw materials away because there is still a lot of value in those materials. So we're going to see those materials coming back again to the supply chain. So I wanted to kind of wrap up the issue of batteries because it's a huge concern in the industry and one that I don't want to ignore. I know people have questions and we will get questions for this, about this for a long time. And we're happy to try to answer those questions to the best of our knowledge. But the truth is, this is a very new industry. We're still learning a lot. We're going to make mistakes and we're going to get better. So, you know, we just need to keep an open mind about that. Now, back to the point of the, you know, the big picture of the energy transition. It's like, yeah, basically, we have created a system in which we depend on fossil fuels that have very low efficiency. So we burn a lot of stuff. And so one of the national labs, the Berkeley Livermore National Lab in California, they create these chart every year that shows energy flows in the economy. And like, I love that thing. Like I have it as a screen saver on my computer because it shows you, I love that thing. I just look at, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm crazy. I know, but you know, but the thing is, it shows you how energy flows in the economy, right? So we get X amount of you know, energy from coal, and we get X amount from natural gas and nuclear and wind and solar. And then it shows you how that energy is used, like, you know, our coal goes into power, electricity generation, natural gas, some of it goes into electricity generation and some of it goes into the industrial sector. And then what you get out of all that energy input is in a small fraction of value. So we put like a whole unit of energy and we get about 30% of that in the form of value. Because at the end of the day, when you put gasoline in your vehicle, what you want is getting from point A to point B. What gives you value to use how far that gasoline takes you, right? And if you put a value on what you actually get out of that gallon of gasoline, you're only getting about 20% of that. That 80%, it becomes waste that goes out of your, you know, tailpipe, and you don't get anything out of that. We have a system that depends on that, and the solution to it is moving to renewables, which is what we're trying to do here in Wisconsin. Because you put solar panels, and all that waste disappears. Because we're not talking about a system that has an efficiency that's dependent on your input, because the sun is shining when it's shining. Like, you have no control over it, and you don't have to pay more when it shines or it doesn't shine. You just get what you get, and you use it, but there is not, like, a loss there, right? Which is the case of, you know, fossil fuels. So big picture, we're trying to move the state towards that, where we have a system that runs on fuels and, you know, electricity that we can generate here. We don't have to send that money out of the state. And we would like to see that on the building sector. We like to see that in the transportation sector and in the industrial sector as well once we get there.
Okay. So essentially, the goal of, you know, your goal is to keep energy money in the state. So how do you do that? I mean, is that through wind, solar, geothermal? Like, what are the ways that we are producing renewable energy in this state? And also, what are the environmental costs of that energy?
For the most part, we're just running the gamut on all of them. We even have near our office over in Fitchburg, there's a school that's running off of quite a few of these. But for the most part, they're utilizing solar power and geothermal. Okay. But they're, I believe, is it the first in the state or the country that's net zero, Francisco?
In the state.
In the state. So we have a net zero school already operating in Fitchburg. And throughout the state, we're using, you know, solar, hydroelectric, wind, geothermal, biogas, which that has some issues with, you know, obviously producing some carbon when you burn it, but we're really using pretty much everything. But there are some issues with solar panels. It's the production, recycling, things like that. But there's also benefits. Farmers are able to rest their soil during the period of use that the solar panels are over that land. So when that project is complete in 30 or 50 years and the panels move or new panels get put up somewhere else, that soil is going to be more fertile.
Geothermal, could you explain exactly what that is for those who don't know and where it's
pick
happening?
Pick me.
Yeah. Go for it, Francisco. Yeah.
You said geothermal, and I got excited because so I have a background in engineering, and most of my professional career has been working in energy efficiency for buildings and new construction. And geothermal is a fantastic technology. And I truly believe that if you're building a new building in Wisconsin, geothermal is probably the most effective, the most efficient system that you can go for, you can install. And you know, we have a lot of schools in Wisconsin, new schools in Wisconsin that have geothermal systems. And I worked on some of these projects and I absolutely love these projects. Sun Prairie has two elementary schools that are geothermal buildings. Verona has a new high school that are geothermal buildings. We're starting to see hospitals. We're seeing hotels that are geothermal buildings. So geothermal in Wisconsin. Oh, before that, we probably have the largest geothermal installation in the country here in Wisconsin over at the Epic campus. A lot of those buildings have geothermal heat pumps for their heating and cooling. So what I'm trying to say in a very long way is geothermal systems are pretty amazing. And if building owners and design teams are actually thinking about what's the best option we can take, we have to take to make a building, you know, more efficient and sustainable, it is geothermal. The way it works, so there's two types of geothermal energy. There is geothermal with a big G and geothermal with a little g. Geothermal with a big G is when you have enough heat on the ground that you can pump that water, usually water, you know, that's very hot, and use it to run a turbine and generate electricity. And we have actually countries that rely on that heavily. We have some of that in the Southwest in the US, but the geothermal energy resource in the US is somewhat limited to some geographic areas because, you know, you need enough heat that you can actually run a turbine with that.
And just for our audience, and honestly myself, there are some places in Wisconsin where the water underneath the bedrock is hot.
Nope. That is geothermal with a big G, and that usually happens. That's usually available in the Southwest of the US.
Got it.
Here,
okay.
In Wisconsin, we don't have that.
Got it.
We don't have geothermal with a big G. We only have geothermal with a little g. And what that means is basically the temperature underground is pretty much constant year round.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if you have a building, you have a home or a factory or a hospital, you have to cool it in the summer and you have to heat it in the winter. And you're fighting against the temperature outside of that building to try to stay within your comfortable range. So let's say you want to keep your house at 70 degrees year round, but you also want to bring some outdoor air and you have to compensate for that heat loss that's going through your windows or your walls. So you have to take air from somewhere, whether it's your side, the side of, you know, inside of the house or outside. And then you want to condition it, bring it back to whatever you want it, 65, 70 degrees, and then make your house comfortable. In the winter, you're going from, if you're taking air from the outside, you're going from, let's say, 0 degrees outside, you're heating that air to 70 degrees and delivering it to your bedroom so you can be nice and comfortable. In the summer, let's say it's 90 degrees outside, you're taking 90 degree air from outside and you're cooling it down to, let's say, 70 and you're delivering to your room. So you have that delta, right? That temperature difference between the air that you're picking up, because you have to bring some outdoor air anyway, just so you're not breathing the same air all the time. You're picking up. Also, your house loses air, like buildings lose air. So, you have to bring some air. You have to fight that difference. If you're using the temperature of the water underground, that difference becomes a lot smaller because now you're going from 65 degrees or 60 degrees underground or 55 degrees underground to 65 or to 70, that's what you want inside your house. So what geothermal systems, what the geothermals with a little g do is they take the heat that is already in the medium and they use that to provide the heat that you want for the space that you're conditioning. So one way to think about it is geothermal systems are basically heat pump systems. And a heat pump is a piece of equipment that takes heat from one space and pump it into another space.
Sure.
So it's just like a water pump, but this one is a heat pump. And we all have one in our house. It's called the refrigerator. So if you own a refrigerator that's like 10 years old or newer, it's a heat pump. And basically what it does is when you put something in the fridge and it's kind of hot, the fridge takes that heat out of that, you know, your hot soup, takes it and pump it outside of the refrigerator. That's why if you walk behind the refrigerator, you kind of feel that heat because it's taking whatever is inside of it, it's hot, it's pumping that heat out. A heat pump for your house does the same thing. The difference with a geothermal heat pump is that it is taking heat from the ground and it's pumping it into your house. So it's using 55 degree water to get heat to bring it into your house rather than using 20 degree air to take up heat and put it inside your house.
I see.
It's complicated. It's a complicated concept, but basically it's like, you know, you have to think about, you have your heat source and your heat sink. You're going to pick up heat from one place and you're going to dump it somewhere else, right? Geothermal heat pumps have a better source because they are always sourcing from the same spot at the same temperature. Your air source heat pump is having to adapt, having to adjust to whatever the temperature is outside to find that heat. So that's what gives it that huge advantage. Got so again, it. You know, best system you can install in a new building. We're seeing it coming up a lot, and there is a reason for that. So, but like Alex said, we support everything. We support solar. We support wind. We support geothermal. We support biofuels. We support electric vehicles because that aligns with our overall strategy, which is we need to electrify things. We need to run as much as we can on electricity so we can eventually run it on renewable electricity. Because if you got, you know, I have a gas furnace at home that I hope I can, you know, transition to a heat pumps one day, but I won't be able to run my gas furnace on a local or locally generated fuel probably ever, because I don't know when we're going to be able to generate, you know, natural gas. I mean, we do have renewable gas from the landfill, but, you know, I'm not connected to that. So I'm always going to be relying on imported fuel to run my furnace at home. If I had a heat pump that run on electricity and I put solar on my roof, I can run my furnace or my heat pump with fuel that I'm generating here. And that's kind of the whole, that's the goal. That's what we're going for.
CBS News Brief. People in Maine are beginning a healing process after the man who killed 18 people in a mass shooting this week is found dead. Maine Public Safety Commissioner Michael Soschuk told reporters this morning.
I think clearly there's a mental health component to this.
Israel's Defense Forces spokesman says through an interpreter that the nation has stepped up its air and ground attacks on the Gaza Strip.
We are acting with the various objectives that we outlined for ourselves with a national effort as well to return our hostages.
Democratic Representative Dean Phillips says he's running against President Biden in 2024. CBS's Robert Costa reports.
Phillips is the first sitting lawmaker to take on Biden, joining Marianne Williamson running against the president in the Democratic race. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West, who have followings on the left, are running as independents.
CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes, don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org, brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Time out.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
93.5, The Tap.
Hey, folks, you're listening to the Cripes Cast on Civic Media. Here is my conversation with Renew Wisconsin.
Your main initiative here is to sort of, you guys have this focus on these buses, right? Why did you choose the buses as the thing to focus on when there's so many other things to focus? I mean, it's difficult being in this position, right? There's so many things to focus on. You got to focus on one thing. Why did you choose the buses for this initiative?
So we're focused on a lot of things. We have a staff that's been growing quite a bit recently, but I would say one of Francisco's main focuses is buses right now. And that's mostly because of funding that's recently been made available through the bipartisan infrastructure law. Over 5 years, starting last year, there's $5 billion available to help school districts make this transition. So during this time period, we're doing everything we can to make sure that Wisconsin is applying for the rebates that are available so they can take advantage of this opportunity.
That is exactly right. I think I kind of pointed to these in my last comment, but, you know, electric vehicles align well with our overall strategy, because unless we electrify these vehicles, we won't be able to run our transportation with local renewable fuel. So we have to make sure that these vehicles run on electricity. You know, first, it's better for people because you eliminate the emissions. Mm-hmm. Second, we can use electricity that can be locally generated. And electric school buses, I believe, provide one of the best opportunities we have to bring everyone into the electrification movement, because, I love electric vehicles. I own an electric car, but they're somewhat expensive still. So sometimes when we talk about electric vehicles, we say, these are for people who have the money. And there is some truth in that argument. I think a lot of people rely on the school bus to send their kids home. I have two kids in the Madison School District, and my kids, one of my kids takes the bus home, take the bus to school. I know a lot of families that rely on the buses to send their kids to school. And, you know, we're familiar with the school bus because it runs through our neighborhoods. We see the school bus, right? So now that the federal government is providing this funding for this program, as Alex said, we find that it is one of the best opportunities that we have to bring the benefits of transportation electrifications to all communities in the state. And this program is almost targeted to rural and low-income communities, because these communities have priorities. So, you know, rural school districts, tribal school districts, and low-income school districts have better incentives. They have more money available, and they're prioritized. So we want to make sure that those communities have access to this funding. So we're helping promote the program, bring awareness to the program, do education about electric vehicles and electric buses and their benefits, and helping people actually, you know, fill out the applications and access those funds.
So that's your hope, like, for coming on here and talking about this with me, you know, are you hoping to just educate people, or do they have to go through certain steps in order to get their school buses electrified?
We're trying to spread that awareness. Not everyone's really aware that this money is available to them. In terms of the process, there is an application, but there's not a lot of like difficult hoops that really need to be jumped through. For the most part, it's you have to give up one of your diesel buses to get the money for the electric bus. You get to hold on to that diesel bus for, I believe it's a year, right, Francisco?
2 years.
2 years. You could hold on to that old bus for 2 years if you decide the electric bus isn't working out for you. But then after those 2 years, you have to give up the diesel bus. For us, there's also a sense of urgency in two ways. One, obviously, there's a time limit to this funding. After 5 years, the opportunity is going to pass. So that's kind of the urgency with trying to create that awareness. But obviously there's not as much of a economic incentive here in terms of, you know, the schools aren't creating a bunch of jobs by getting these new buses. The urgency is really a health situation. So we have, I believe it's about every day, 25 million American children are on a bus. There's just a lot of health issues that arise when you're regularly exposed to diesel fumes. Most studies have indicated that there's just no safe level of exposure to these fumes. And typically those fumes are about five times worse on the bus than they are outside of the bus.
Oh, interesting. So this is for your kids' health to not be inhaling those diesel fumes while they go to school every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it causes asthma, headaches. It makes kids tired. So they're just not performing as well in school as they could if they weren't being exposed to these fumes. So if we can get kids onto electric buses that we believe are going to perform just as well for what they need to do, we're just going to protect the health of kids who have small developing lungs.
Got it. So who then, I guess, is not currently enrolled in this program? Like, is there a school? So you would think like MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools, various rural school districts, like, are they not applying for it currently? Is that why you're trying to get the message out? Are there areas of the state that could really benefit from knowing about this, where you're seeing a shortage in applications for these electric school buses?
So this is an EPA program that has two components. One component is a grant where school districts can send their applications, a competitive process where they can compete against other districts and get a number of buses. And the other component is a rebate. So it's a very simple application. It's basically a two-page application online, and it's a lottery. So as long as they enter their name, you know, they put the name in the hat, and, you know, if the computer selects them, they get the bus. So in Wisconsin, we have last year, so in 2022, the EPA released the first round of rebates, and that came out in the summer, and they released the winners in the fall. So in that list, or during that round of funding, there were 198 school districts listed as priority school districts for that program in Wisconsin. So if you were one of those school districts, you could go online, enter your information on that online application, and then just wait. And if the EPA will select you through the lottery process, then you will get your award. So we had about 30% of the school districts in that priority list apply for the program. And we receive about 19 awards for the state. Out of those awards, we got 65 electric school buses going into 15 different school districts. And there was a wait list. So some districts apply and they didn't get selected. So they went onto a wait list that the EPA would use in case some of these districts will decide, you know, we won, but we don't want the money, so we're going to give it back. The EPA was going to go back to that wait list and select the next one in the list, right? So like I said, we have 198 school districts in that priority list, about 30% apply. We want to see every single school district in the state in that list apply for this rebate. Because the way I see it is, this is a replacement program where the schools will get the funding to replace diesel buses. And if you think about a school district or a transportation contractor, because this is also available to transportation contractors. So if the school district has a company that provides transportation for them, that transportation contractor can apply and access these funds on behalf of the school. So let's say if the school or the transportation contractor owns a bus, a diesel bus that is, you know, throw me a number, like 5 years old, 10 years old, you know, how much is that bus worth? So how much is a school bus worth, that 10-year-old school bus today, diesel bus?
I mean, let me get on Craigslist for a second here. Hang on.
Right.
I don't know. How much is a 10-year-old school bus?
Let's be generous. Let's say it's $30,000, right?
That's it?
Well, let's say it's $50,000.
That's
being
generous.
Okay. Yeah, that's being super generous, right?
Okay.
And here it is EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, saying, how would you like to trade that bus for a $375,000 bus?
Yeah.
We will give you 2 years where you can, you have both. Like you get to keep your trade-in for 2 years until you figure out how to make this new electric bus work. And then at the end of those 2 years, you have to either sell that bus or you have to donate it or you have to scrap it, right? So the way I see it is this is a pretty like low risk situation for a school district where they get 2 years to try out that new electric bus. And if it doesn't really work for them, well, that's a conversation they got to have with EPA later, because if an electric school bus doesn't work for a district, we have work to do on the system. We have to figure out why it's not working, because it is working for a lot of districts. We have had electric buses in Michigan for about 3 years now, operating very successfully. We've had them in Minnesota. We have them in Illinois. We had electric school bus operating in Alaska, right? Because that's one of the issues. Like people think like, well, it is cold in Wisconsin. How are these buses going to work? They work just fine. What happens is that your battery, your range decreases in the winter because batteries don't like being cold. And as an EV driver, you probably have experienced this, that in the winter, your range goes down by 30%, maybe.
Yeah.
So same thing happens to electric school buses. That doesn't mean that you cannot use it. It means that you got to have a battery that's big enough to cover your route in the winter and in the summer. And here at Renew, we develop a tool that we can use to simulate routes for a school district. So when we're working with a school district, we can go into the tool, select one specific bus, and they can specify the route. And we can see how the bus will perform for that route. We can model how long it would take to recharge it, how much it's going to cost to recharge it. And then we compare that to a diesel bus so they can see kind of the savings that they can expect from the transition.
Sure. Okay. And then if that is the case where it seems like everything is good, what areas in Wisconsin do you think are kind of low on the application process for these buses perhaps and would most benefit? That way, if somebody hears, oh, this is my school district or my area, maybe I can bring this up to those folks. Are there any areas in Wisconsin that you think are under applying for this, for these electric buses, these free buses?
Yeah, good question. So if we look at the map of the applications and the prioritization, it's pretty even across the state. So I'm actually looking at a map that I created here in Google Maps where the districts are, and it's pretty uniform across the state. I mean, a lot of schools in the south part of the state, you know, pretty much everywhere, because it's a lottery. The distribution of awards was also pretty even. Like we're getting buses in Palmyra, you know, which is south of here, Madison. We're getting buses in Minocqua. We're getting buses in Granton. We're getting buses in Wild Rose. So last year, the 15 awards for electric school buses were pretty well distributed. We want to see the same distribution this year when the program is announced again, but we just want to see more of those. So instead of, you know, 33% of the prioritized school districts applying, we want to see 100% of the prioritized districts applying, because that's going to give us a bigger chance of getting more buses in the state. So just to put things kind of in kind of like, you know, to see how we're doing nationwide, we were super excited when the awards were announced last year and we got 65 buses in the state. Now, mm-hmm. Michigan got 138.
Oh, Michigan, you know, they got the UP and more buses. That's not fair.
Well, we got to beat Michigan, right? And I love Michigan. I have a lot of good friends in Michigan, but we got to beat Michigan somehow.
Yeah.
Because they're doing great work when it comes to electrification. Part mm-hmm. of the reason is because they have a history with school buses, right? They have been running electric school buses for a few years now, so they are comfortable with the technology. We don't have that in Wisconsin. We are happy to connect school districts here in Wisconsin with districts in Michigan who have the experience. So if they want to talk to them, you know, they can give me a call and I can make that connection. But we really need the school districts here to start embracing the technology. I know it's a risk, but it's a risk worth taking.
Sure.
Yeah, and sure. Generally, trying to get more to the point of that question, really anywhere in Wisconsin can benefit from these buses. They have the range to handle most routes that kids are on. You know, I think the highest range for one bus company we were doing an event with recently is 155 miles. If you do 155 miles or 120 in the morning, charge in the middle of the day, get back almost all the way up to 100% charge, you got 150 again. I don't think there's many kids out there in Wisconsin that have a 3-hour bus route that they're sitting on that goes beyond 150 miles. So they have the range to operate. One of the hiccups, though, I believe, is having the connection to the utilities to be able to charge. And I think Francisco can detail that a little bit. That's one of our main challenges for certain areas.
Yeah. Well, you know, with an electric vehicle, bus being one of those, you have to think about how you charge your vehicle, right? How you charge these buses. So the EPA provides funding for that. So last year, the rebate was $375,000 per bus plus $20,000 for the charging station to serve that bus. Now, depending on the situation of the school or the transportation contractor, they might not have enough electrical power to support 2 or 3 EV chargers for buses. So that location, whether it is the bus depot or, you know, the bus barn of the school, might need some electrical upgrades. We believe that the best thing you can do to figure that out is, as soon as you apply for the rebate, talk to your utility, because your utility wants to help you with this, right? This is a benefit to the utility, because now you're going to provide new revenue to the utility, because you're going to purchase electricity. You're going to stop sending that money somewhere else to buy diesel fuel, and you're going to send that money straight to the utility down the road that's going to provide you with your fuel, right? Mm-hmm. Talk to the utility to make sure that you have the service that you need to charge your buses. We saw some issues related to that with the last round of rebates, with the last round of awards, because the program is so easy that some of the school districts apply and then they receive the notification, hey, you got a free bus. And then they went to talk to the utility and say, we're going to need to plug this bus. And the utility said, well, you need to upgrade your service, which is going to cost you a few thousand dollars. So the school staff went and talked to the boards or the community and said, hey, we're going to need, let's say, $10,000 to upgrade our service. And then that became a barrier because the school was not planning on spending additional $10,000. So they were like, you know, we don't want that bus. You told us it was a free bus. And now you're telling us we have to spend $10,000 to get the free bus. That doesn't mean free. And that is true, right? That's why we believe that this conversation needs to start, like, you know, involve your school board, involve your utility, and bring your community in if you can from the beginning. So when you get that award, it's not a surprise that you are going to have, you might or might not have to make some upgrades to your utility service in order to get that charging station connected.
Well, that's a big question is and it's not just with buses, but as electric cars become more and more, can the U.S. grid handle that, you know, and what are the upgrades happening to the grid? Like, what is going on with the grid to ensure that this electric future is possible?
Yeah. Oh, you're bringing up all the big questions, man. Can the electric grid handle the transition to electric transportation? The answer is yes by most of the models that we see out there. So if you look at Wisconsin's kind of projection for electrification of transportation, the DOT projects that we're going to have about 30% EVs by 2050. So we have a long way to go, right? This is not going to happen overnight. Now, if you think about how the electricity market works, it's very valuable, right? And it's very predictable. We have low demand when people are sleeping. We have high demand when people are home cooking and they want their air conditioning on. So, you know, you have a demand that is a curve that goes up. And at some point in the middle of the day when it's hot, everyone is using electricity and the utilities are scrambling to bring electricity, you know, to the system so we don't get brownouts or blackouts. Mm-hmm. And then that goes down. And power becomes so cheap that some generators either shut down because they don't have anywhere to send that power, or they just give it for free and say, like, you know, if you want electricity, you can have it because we don't need it right now and it's overwhelming the grid, right? It's a system that's like, it's ups and downs. Like, you know, what I'm trying to say is we have enough of a resource. We just have to figure out how to time it correctly. That's when electric vehicles come into play, because you have the ability to program your EV to charge whenever you want to charge. And when electricity is cheap and generators are trying to give it away, that's when you charge.
Okay. But you said the buses have to charge in the middle of the day, right, too?
Like, no, not necessarily, no.
Only on that 150, only in those extreme cases where it's going over 150 miles in the morning and then at night, basically, right?
Right, right. Okay. And we actually don't want any school district really charging during the middle of the day, because they're going to be subjected to demand charges, which is, so the utilities don't like it really when you ask for a lot of power, when everybody's asking for a lot of power. That's why they charge you something called a demand charge. And there is a window of time, depending on your utility. Some of them are like Monday to Friday, 1 to 4 p.m. or 1 to 6 p.m., where if you plug in something, they're going to charge you for plugging that thing, not the electricity, but just for plugging it, for the demand that you're putting on the grid. And they're going to charge you for the entire year, even if you just plug in one. Because what they're thinking is, we can't control when you plug that thing, and we have to build the infrastructure to make sure that when you plug it, it works and it doesn't create costs in the system. So we're going to build it so you have it available, but we're going to charge you for it, even if you only use it once. So demand charges are very high. So, you know, some of the Wisconsin utilities, they have a $13 per kilowatt demand charge, meaning if you plug something that is 1 kilowatt just once during the demand period, they're going to charge you $13 every month, even though you only plug it once.
Well, that seems weird.
It's not weird, though, because they have to actually build that infrastructure to serve you. But the utilities have the obligation to serve. That's why they have a monopoly, right? You can't compete with the utility because the utility has a monopoly, but they also have the obligation to provide service when you need it. So they have to build the infrastructure to allow for that. And the way they do it is they build it and then they charge you for it.
Okay.
And they don't want to charge you, you know, they're not going to send you a bill for, you know, oh, you have to put bigger wires because now you have this thing that you want to plug in the middle of the day and it draws a lot of power. So here's a bill for $10,000. They're not going to do that. They just say, okay, we're just going to split this into, you know, 20 years and we're going to charge you, you know, every month we're going to charge you $13 so we get our money back. So that was a long way to say we really don't like districts charging during the day because of those demand charges. If you need to do it, you can go ahead and do it. But for most cases, districts are going to be okay charging overnight.
Okay.
And that's why we have this tool where if the utility give us their route, we can put it through our tool and determine, you know, how many routes they can complete with one charge. And if they have to charge during the day, what will be the ideal time to plug their buses?
Okay. Well, great, guys. Well, hey, listen, this was super informative, and we're almost out of time. So before I direct people to where they can get more information about this, is there anything I forgot to bring up that you think is super important?
I don't think so. I think it was a good conversation. I let Alex say something about this. I think, you know, something to keep in mind is during this clean transition, we're not trying to enforce anything on anybody. We're not trying to force like people to go one way or another. We just want to have the opportunity to have a conversation about something that we're doing and the options that we have available on the market that might result in, you know, better quality of life for people, probably, you know, better health outcomes. So, you know, if people are doing, you know, whatever, they have a school district that they have to run and they have to get kids to the schools, there is this technology.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.